seemed like you had some crazy traveling this week happening.
I had a little bit of traveling. This was, you know, I'm tempted to, I've used the term obligatory family obligation. Or no, that doesn't make sense. Obligatory family vacation.
Oh, right. I remember that because we were, what were we emailing about? T-shirt sizing or something like that for ordering t-shirts. And you were going through this whole email thread with me. And eventually Amanda, your assistant Amanda, jumped in. She was like, Pat, if you don't get off this email chain and take your goddamn vacation, I'm going to find you and hunt you down.
Yeah, yeah, she's good. She's good about that. And she knows way more about, you know, about what we do with the t-shirts these days than I do. Yeah, it's, you know, I, my dad has a cabin up in the North Woods, and we had set aside some time, not just for us to go and hang out, but to take the kids up there so that they get some grandpa time and he gets some kid time. And yeah, it's weird, but you know, this won't sound weird to you. It's just, you know, taking time off to just have a vacation feels like super irresponsible. With as much stuff as I have going on, and as behind as I am on so many of these projects and how many other things are coming up. You know, when I asked Sarah, I go, so we're going up to the cabin, right? And she goes, yeah. And I go, when are we leaving? And she's like, you know, Wednesday. And I'm like, this Wednesday? She's like, yeah. And I go, how long are we up there? She goes, till the 5th. And I'm like, a week? We're spending a week up there? And it's just like the thought of spending a week on a vacation was just, it was horrifying to me because I had so much going on. So we went up, you know, a day later, and I did a little work while I was there, but it was good. It was good.
I'm very bad at taking vacations. So I tend to, I'm a very anxious traveler, and sometimes that, I feel like one of the ways that that manifests is in terms of the things that I'm going to bring to travel with. So I tend to obsess a lot over like packing and shopping for the right, just the right things to travel with. And of course I always dramatically overpack, and I never need any of the crazy contingency things that I bring to travel, or, you know, all of the books that I bring, or will I have enough entertainment for the airplane? And I wind up bringing my, you know, like packing my entire life into a suitcase. And then of course I don't want it because I'm doing stuff when I'm traveling. But I also have the same problem of like, you know, whether I'm on a vacation, which I guess I don't really take very many vacations, but when I'm supposed to be on vacation or whatever, or even just when I take a day off or I'm have a weekend, you know, I want stuff to do. Like I don't know. Like I can't tell if it's, I struggle with like when I'm at home on a weekend and I'm like, this feels like I'm wasting time, or like I'm anxious, like I'm getting away with something, or like I should be accomplishing something or doing something with my time, you know, putting my time to productive use. I can't tell, like, is that an instinct that I should basically like nurture in myself, that like, you know, industriousness of like, oh, this is why I've gotten stuff done in my life, is because I think of every moment of like, how can I make the most of a moment of a day of my life? Or is it really unhealthy? Like ultimately is my job and the things that I worry so much about of like, you know, it's just writing fart jokes for people. Like it's not, I'm not a vet, right? I'm not like saving lives or anything.
Yeah. I don't know. I've been hanging out with people and spending time with people. And, you know, part of the problem is that you compare somebody else's on stage to your backstage. So like you look at all these people, or you're on Twitter and you're like, wow, so-and-so has a book out, or, oh, this project is happening for this person. And it seems like everyone is always putting things out and getting things done. And so you compare that, or like I compare that to what I get done, and it doesn't feel like a lot, but that's like also a weird observer bias, you know, where I remember I was at NerdCon last year, and I was on a panel with John Green, and we were talking about like how, you know, the interaction with Hollywood you know, like the upside downside to that. And he said something like, you know, I haven't put out a book in 3 years or 4 years or whatever he named a number of years. And I'm like, I lean over so I can see him. And I'm like, John, it's like, think about who you're on a panel with here. And he said, you put out a book last year. And I thought, what? And I go, oh yeah. Well, I go, oh yeah, Slow Regard did come out. I go, but you know, I haven't put out a real book, you know, in 5-6 years. And he's like that book that hit the New York Times bestseller list and that everybody loved. And, you know, and I'm like, well, but you know, no, like the book that everyone wants and the book that I want to finish, I haven't finished that book. So nothing else matters. I don't know. I think what I've run into people, and you know, different things used to impress me. You know, like if somebody was really good at something, or if somebody like could play the guitar, or you know, like if people with skills, or maybe they'd met somebody really cool, or they'd gotten to do something really cool. But these days, the people that really impress me are people who like go and do a job and then stop doing a job and then have fun and like then don't work on a weekend and then they're happy and then they go back and then they do more work and they get projects done. And I look at those people and I'm like, I just don't understand how they live their lives. I'm like, wow, how do you do what you do? And they're like what? Sometimes stop working and like have dinner and hang out with friends. I'm like, yeah, how do you do that? Like what, when did you turn that corner in your life where you were able to accomplish this magic? I don't know.
Yeah. I can't remember where this is from. It's like some Buddhist thing where there's supposed to be five. Some Buddhist practice holds that there's like five grades of happiness. Really? So, yeah. So, and I think about this all the time. So there's minor happiness, which is an experience that is, it only raises the hairs on your body. There's momentary happiness, which is like flashes of lightning at different moments. There's showering happiness, which breaks over your body again and again, like waves on the seashore. There's uplifting happiness, which is the highest level, which can be powerful enough to levitate the body and make it spring up into the air. And then there's, oh wait, that's 1, 2, 3, 4. Oh wait, no, the highest one is pervading rapturous happiness when the body is completely pervaded, like a filled bladder or a rock cavern invaded by a huge inundation. Those are the five ones. You have the hairs on the body, the flashes of lightning, the happiness breaking over your body again and again, levitating the body and springing up into the air, and then like the rock cavern invaded by a huge inundation.
You know, that's kind of a mouthful. I think that fifth level,
yeah,
we should just call Hamilton.
Oh, we're back on the Hamilton.
I thought I would be better by now. I thought like maybe it would get out of my system. You know, and it's not like I have, this is a borderline like sickness. I have a Hamilton sickness.
Here's one thing with the happiness. Sometimes I think about this Buddhist thing all the time with these five grades of happiness. And I think a lot. So like, I would say like one of the main sources of happiness in my life is like going out to a nice dinner with Veronica. And that would be for me a minor happiness. It raises the hairs on my body. Like the food is so good that I get a little thrill from it, right? And then, of course, the experience and the conversation and doing that. Then there is the happiness of, like, some sort of, like, external recognition of, like, winning, getting an award or a good review or something. And that would be, like, another one of the lower ones, like flashes of lightning, right, where it's like, oh, like, a good feeling that lifts me up for the day. And then there's another kind of happiness for me, which I would actually identify as some of the happiest moments of my life, which are getting into a state of flow, doing work that I know is really good while I'm doing it. And that's not all the time. I mean, it's very rare, but sometimes I do have those moments of like, it's late at night and I'm working on something and I'm like, this is so good. And I'm just pushing it forward. And everything just falls away and it's just me and the work. And it's that very Zen moment. And that might be like the third grade of happiness, where it's showering happiness that breaks over the body again and again, like waves on the seashore. But in terms of the latter two, the real two, the ones where your whole body is completely pervaded, like a rock cavern invaded by a huge inundation, I don't know that I've ever felt that.
You know, it is interesting because I was just talking with Sarah last night about different types of happiness. You know, I said, your happiness is really important to me. And I go, and I wish there was, you know, I want you to be happy as possible. And then I stopped and I said, of course, I'm talking about enlightened hedonism here. And she goes, and like, even before I finished that statement, she goes, yeah, I know what you mean. And of course, what I meant was, you know, in back in the day, you know, hedonism was this philosophical construct where they'd say, you know, whatever, happiness is the greatest good was the basic tenet of that. And, or pleasure rather, is the greatest good. And of course, that philosophical construct falls apart like super fast because, you know, it just is not a tenable, sustainable life strategy. And then of course they came out with enlightened hedonism, or, you know, even like Epicureanism, you know, not in the modern sense of being an epicure, but in the old sense of following the practices of Epicure, you know, where you cultivate, and there they say first off, you have to take the long view. It's like your solution to every problem cannot be, I will eat 100 cakes, you know, because that's where hedonism falls apart. They say, you say, huh, you know, I have a problem. I haven't studied for this test. I can either stay up all night and be really tired. I can stay up all night and study and take the test, but I'll be tired. Or I can not study and take the test and maybe do badly. Or I can eat 100 cakes. You know, and then like when you look at that, you're like, boy, or you're like, huh, you know, I'm in a bad relationship. I can either work really hard and maybe it'll get better and maybe it won't. Or I can try to disentangle myself from this bad relationship, which is going to be extraordinarily stressful and emotionally exhausting. Or I can eat 100 cakes, you know? And that's where hedonism falls apart is, you know, basic hedonism, your answer should always be, you know, I'm going to eat 100 cakes, you know, or have like a nice refreshing wank. And, do you like that expression, a refreshing wank?
A nice refreshing wank.
Nice refreshing wank.
There's a Cards Against Humanity card for us.
Oh, if you use that, that would delight me to no end. It sort of has an effervescent quality to it. Ah, how refreshing. You know, enlightened hedonism says you have to look at the pleasure you gain in the long term. And also it starts to grade pleasures. And they're like, you know, the pleasure you feel, say, spending time with somebody who you love is perhaps a different sort of pleasure or a greater pleasure than, you know, just eating cake. And, you know, once you start qualifying or systematizing, and I will admit I have like this huge delight in systematization. So when you I've never heard of this, these five levels of happiness before, because, you know, one of the things I've talked about is a lot of times there's a lot of things I can do, but the pleasure, the joy, or the satisfaction that I feel the day after I've done some writing in the novel is very different from most other forms of happiness. You know, if I sit down and I get work done on the novel, it's weird because if I finish a poem, I can show people a poem. if I finish a blog, people will enjoy the blog. If I do a fundraiser, you know, we make money for a fundraiser. But all of those joys do not feel the same as this odd and you know, it, honestly, it's a resultless effort, you know, because you're writing one page in a novel. There's nothing I can really show to anyone. There's nothing, there's no product in a practical sense. But the next day, I will feel good. I'll feel kind of strong or purposeful or powerful in a way that I don't feel otherwise. That's really, I'm actually looking, I'm looking for this online, these five.
It's from, so I looked up where it's from. It's from this fourth century meditation manual by an Indian Buddhist named Buddhaghosa. And the manual is called the Visuddhimagga. I'm probably butchering this. But anyway.
And it's called the five types or five...
The five grades of happiness. And allegedly, I should also say, like, I'm kind of, like, you know, bastardizing this, because, like, allegedly, these are the five grades of happiness you can achieve through meditation. But I just think it's an interesting, like, you know, way of thinking about, well, exactly what you were saying, of, like, some kinds of happiness are higher than others.
And, you know, that's actually really interesting, because when you mentioned it, and you said, like, this is the sort of happiness that lifts you into the air. And you'd mentioned Buddhism, you know, in classic Buddhism, as you meditated toward the end goal of nirvana, which is the realization that nothing exists and that you are not real, and effectively the realization of the non-existence of the self, which is a profoundly, you know, like nigh impossible concept for anyone, especially in the West, to get their head around. But as you are meditating and as you're trying to, like, get your head around these big concepts, a lot of, you know, Buddhists would experience, and boy, it's been a long time since I've studied this, you would experience, like, symptoms of your increasing enlightenment. And one of those, you know, and one
is,
of
is this like the Indian yogis where they can eat, they can live just off of sunlight and they can levitate, allegedly?
It's tied pretty closely together, where, like, a lot of the Buddhists, you know, they would say that some of the things that would happen as you get closer and closer, because, and it actually, it's a very cohesive philosophy, because, you know, if you really believe that all things are illusion, then, you know, and it's very, God, and I hate bringing in popular media, but, you know, the one that everyone will probably have been exposed to is The Matrix,
mm-hmm.
You know, where, you know, where the little kid goes, you don't bend the spoon. The secret is to realize that there is no spoon. And that's what happens as you meditate. You're like, the world, all is illusion. The world is illusion. And so the ability to do odd things isn't that odd if you actually are gaining realization that the world is not real. And therefore, you know, a lot of these advanced monks would experience things like levitation. Hmm. And the problem is, you know, a lot of people would say, ooh, shit, now I want to be a Buddhist and I'll get superpowers. But they view those, you know, real Buddhists, you know, who are kind of following this core philosophy, they would identify those things as distractions and honestly as traps. Because if you're like, oh, shit, I can levitate. Oh, I can ignore the demands of my body. I don't need to eat. I'm invulnerable to cold or the elements. They're like, whoa, whoa, whoa. No, you just forgot. It's all an illusion. It doesn't matter. You got to let it go.
I like where the line between Buddhist monk and X-Man starts to blur.
You know, honestly, the further up you get any, like, philosophical food chain or any thought chain, really, any conceptual chain, the more things become similar. It's like real hard-ass philosophy and real hard-ass quantum physics end up overlapping to a really huge degree. The big thing is that very few people follow both of their paths, you know, all the way up through that development tree and realize that a lot of these things are the same. But when you mentioned that fourth level one is, this is a pleasure which like levitates the body, that might not be.
It may be more literal, right? Yeah, yeah. I'm looking at this whole thing figuratively. Here's one that might interest you. So I got into meditation. In college was where I started like a meditation practice, and we had like a meditation club in school that was really helpful in terms of just like introducing me to the fundamentals and the ideas and stuff. And for me, it's always been about managing my anxiety, and it's like a thing where like I suspect that I have some sort of low grade anxiety disorder that actually brings me a lot of problems and misery in my life, but I don't really want to do anything about it. And my meditation practice actually helps me deal with my anxiety issues, or it's at least just like some sort of crutch that I can tell myself that I'm leaning on, where it's like, you know, it's enough of a story to say for me to say to myself, oh, well, I'm doing something to address this. But I did find, I found this psych study that I love. So it's these two psychologists, Daniel Brown and Jack Engler. They did a study of experienced meditators, and they found that people who are frequent meditators are just as anxious as everybody else. So there's no reduction in the amount of anxiety experienced in life by people who meditate. And there was no lessening of internal conflict, but they did find a marked non-defensiveness in experiencing such conflicts among their subjects.
Oh.
Isn't that interesting? So it's like, well, yeah, we have anxiety, but that's just how it is. It's like there is no spoon. It's like, well, that's just the way that I'm feeling right now. And this is the part of Buddhism that, and I think we touched on this a couple weeks ago, but this is the part that really speaks to me, which is there's a difference between pain and suffering.
Yes.
There's no life experience absent pain. Pain is the thing that's going to happen that is part of being alive. Now, how much you suffer, that is a choice. That is what you bring to the table as the subject.
God, yeah, that's very well said. And then I think the distinction between pain and suffering is such an overlooked one. And it's so important to, you know, to like everyday life, like literally everyday life, every hour of your life. I was just talking to a friend, and, you know, I mean, we record this before it's released, but today, you know, there's the guy that got killed by the police, you know.
Did you watch the video of that by any chance?
I opened up the window to watch the video, and I looked at it, and I stopped, and I walked away from it. And it's partly because of the conversation I was having with this friend. We were, you know, kind of messaging back and forth, and you know, she said, "I'm just heartsick today," and I'm like, "Can I help? You know, like, 'cause I'm a fixer. I want to fix everything, especially like when my friends are unhappy." And she's like, "Well, it's just she actually let me read." Her quote here, she said, "Are you able to fix the ills of society caused by generation of systemic racism?" So I'm like, you know, can I help? Can I help? And she's like, "Well, can you do this?" And I'm like, "Okay, I'll put that on the list." And we started to talk about it. And I was chatting with her, and she's like, "I feel," and I said, "I know this is bad, but we're exposed to these bad things every day. And I feel the same. And what I struggle with is, what's the line between being informed and, you know, doing my duty as a citizen of the world and dwelling on the horribleness of the world to the point where I become emotionally exhausted and used up, And you know, that's a really hard thing for me. And I think it's a hard thing for a lot of people who have a great deal of empathy, you know, or people who have a great desire to make the world a better place, or a great deal of desire to be informed about the world. You know, all of those things kind of snowball. And especially, and you know, back in the day, your world used to be, you know, a fucking village. Like, you and 150 other people kind of clustered around some farmland, doing your goddamn best not to starve from year to year. And that worked really well, because then if you stayed informed, and that was gossip and news, and you talked to people, and then you find out that, like, Jeb has been beating his wife, and you get upset, and you go and take care of that shit, you know? And... you know, and then the this community becomes informed, and outrage serves a purpose, and you self-police. But the thing is, you did not have something to become outraged about, something that would flip all your emotional switches. You weren't exposed to that three times a day. And these days, the things that we're exposed to are so systemic that I can't go talk to frickin' Jeb, who lives three huts down, you know? And so I'm torn between this desire to be a good citizen of the world. And, you know, what she mentioned, she said, you know, she says, I feel the need to be informed, but I don't know what to do with that knowledge. And then she said, the least I can do is educate myself so that I don't need to ask persecuted groups of people to educate me. And that struck me as like an extraordinarily intelligent thing to say, and useful. You know, that's a productive use of her time and energy.
Oh boy, do I have thoughts about this?
Yeah, and then she said, I hope that there is value in bearing witness and letting it be known that these things were seen. And hopefully that she wants to be an ally by finding and amplifying voices that should be heard. And she goes, all of these things require me reading the news, even when that news makes me sick. And you know, this is something I struggle with too, because yeah, I'm always looking to make the world a better place, to the point where it's probably a borderline disorder. And you know, yeah,
let me talk. I mean, I have a thought that ties a lot of this conversation together. Yeah, that's interesting. Please. So I'm curious what you think about this. So part of me, you know, we were talking before about, how did you put it, where it's like when you're comparing, you know, everyone else's, how did you say it? Like, their success when they post about it on Twitter to your everyday.
Yeah, it's their on stage to your backstage.
That's exactly it. And what I was thinking when you were talking about that, you know, there's this effect that's happened, I guess, with the rise of like 24-hour news media, where right now it is, by most metrics that you could measure it, it's like the safest, best, most inclusive time to be alive, no matter across all demographics, no matter who you are. You'd never want to pick another time in history to be alive. Like, this is the best, safest, most peaceful time in the history of the human species. And pretty good, but not uncontroversial Steven Pinker book called, I think it's called like The Better Angels of Our Nature, that goes through this argument in great depth. But I largely buy it. I mean, I think there's many problems, you know, like for example, the systemic racism that we're seeing in all of these like police murders that have come out in the last few years. I don't mean to say everything is perfect, but I think like, in, as a broad trend, like things are really good right now. However, with the rise of 24-hour news media, people are left with, because you hear about every act of violence and every plane crash and every kidnapping, people are left with the emotional feeling that it's actually a very dangerous, scary time to be alive.
Yeah. Yeah. It's exactly the mechanism that's taking place. And it's worse the more you are tuned into social media, because it's much more likely to cluster around events that you find important, either because Facebook is using a metric on you and putting you in an echo chamber, or because on Twitter you're following like-minded people.
Isn't that, but that's sort of the same thing of when you go on Twitter and everyone's like announcing all their new shit that they did, you're seeing their onstage stuff and you're comparing it to your offstage stuff. It's like, well, if you're looking at the news and you're looking at that 24-hour news cycle, you're seeing the onstage events, but you're not seeing all the offstage events where it's like, well, things are pretty good for most people.
Right. You know, people, you know, them doing a news report and saying, you know, compared to last year, there's 13% less horrible murders.
Right.
You know, that's like, that's not a news story. No, there's going to be no clicks there. That's a really good point. You know, and in to substantiate what you just said, it was, I'm going to double check this. And I feel embarrassed that I don't, I want to say that it's Hank Green. At the end of last year, I think it was last year, he did a video saying, you know, it's easy to think that things are terrible, but here's the truth. Everything is way better than it ever has been. And he, you know, in his little 3-minute video, he went through and talked about the fact that child mortality was the lowest it's ever been in human history. You know, poverty is better than it's ever been in recorded history. You know, and he lists all of these things. It's like, not just an uptick or not just whatever. It's like, it is markedly, statistically, verifiably better in all these ways. And it's interesting because we can acknowledge that intellectually, but so much of what we are as creatures is not intellectual. We respond to these things based on this old monkey junk code we have in our DNA.
Well, I mean, this is the now, just to be sure our listeners, this is I'm not about to write, this is not my viewpoint, but I do feel like this is, to me, a well-formed sort of conservative argument that conservatives say when they say, well, the income inequality and the wealth gap don't really matter. Again, I'm not saying I agree with this. I'm just reporting the alternate viewpoint to my own. But the argument that I find challenging and interesting is, it's wrong to look at the richest people and say how much richer they are than us. And that's not really an important or useful or helpful measure of where society is. What's actually the interesting measure is, how good are the poorest people? Like, comparatively, yes, how good is most of society doing to the times in the past? And the argument is, well, even though income inequality is growing dramatically, if you filter out the people who are doing really well at the top, just ignore them for a moment, and just look at the people, the world's poor, the very poor people, it is a good time. If you had to be among the poorest people in the world, this is a good time in world history to find yourself in that scenario in terms of the access to food and technology, like air conditioning is like starting to become affordable, and medicine and things like that.
Even more than that, one of my favorite metrics for baseline metrics is the cost of an hour of light.
Oh man!
Because think about it, you know, because if you cannot produce light, then you are effectively a slave to your environment. And, you know, that means it's nighttime. It's like, what can you do? Well, anything that does not require light, which is like anything that doesn't require your eyes. That means if you need to study, you can't study. If you want to read, you can't read. You can't improve yourself or educate yourself in traditional ways. If there's a craft or like a home craft or an industry you want to pursue, like weaving or spinning thread or even making food, you know, and throughout history, I mean, think about it. We're living in a fucking amazing goddamn golden age, literally, in terms of light, where we just flip a switch, where if you go back even like 100 years, light is something like, you know, like a candle. You don't have any idea how expensive a candle was, because you either got to make that out of fat, you know, which you would be better off eating so you don't fucking starve, or you're making it out of beeswax, and that's like a huge luxury item, or oil, or kerosene. But it's like, you can't go to the fucking, you know, Quick Trip and fill up your fucking kerosene because you don't have a car, you know? So like the availability of cheap light is a great metric for the improvement of the baseline human condition.
That is so crazy. I've never really thought through that before, but I've heard stories of like, I know, like, I think it might have been in New England, there was like a species of oily seabird and they were hunted to extinction because what people would do is they would catch these birds and like basically kill them and then thread like a wick through the bird and just light the bird. And yep. The oil from the bird would be the candle. And these things became so rare. I mean, this is what you would have for a candle in some parts of the country. And these things became so rare and valuable that it was like a special treat that like once a week you could stay awake and do things by candlelight. And now I think in most of the world, people have access to light.
Yes, they have access to light. But, you know, and I'm gonna actually check my facts before I riff it off the top of my head. I want to say that 60% of the world's population, mind you, cook their meals over an open flame, you know, and like, that's hard to get your head around. Cause like in some ways that's even beyond light. If you want to cook food, you have to cook it over a fire. Now keep in mind, we're not talking about they have a brazier. Mm-hmm. We're not talking about a Weber grill. We're not talking about a fireplace. Because if you live in a house with a fireplace, you have masonry, you have a lot of construction stuff. Half of the world cooks over an open fire. And if you've ever really cooked something over an open fire, I mean, you know that it's a huge pain in the ass. It takes a long time and you can burn yourself and breathe smoke. One of the statistics is that smoke from cooking fires is such a detriment to health is that it kills about 4 million people every year.
That's crazy. I've never thought about this.
This is why I work with Heifer International, because Heifer International, it's not just, oh, you give people egg or chickens so the chickens have eggs. So then whatever. Heifer does crazy systematic support of infrastructure in communities. So what they do is they bring in, like, say, goats, or maybe they bring in heifers or whatever, but pretty much any farm requires manure and requires animals to be sustainable. It makes a little ecosystem on a farm, and animals produce shit, right? It's just, that's the way the world works. And this poop, if you take it, there's something called a manure digester. It's a biogas digester. And so what happens is it's pretty much a cement slab and the animals poop there and you hose it off into a big pond and that's going to give off methane, right? Which is awful for the environment and it's awful for everything, except you sluice it into this pool and they put a big concrete semi like hemisphere, like a dome over it. And the methane bubbles up into the dome, into this inverted cup. And so the methane collects there. And because it comes up, you know, and the edges of this dish are under the water, the methane comes up and pressurizes itself. And then you can actually turn a spigot. And this methane comes out and people use it to cook, you know, in a way that does not bring a bunch of smoke into their house, that doesn't let their children get burned on hot coals. It's faster. It's more efficient. You don't have to cut down trees. You don't have to spend all your time gathering firewood. Or this methane is cheap light. And what does it cost you? It costs you fucking nothing because it's a byproduct of animal shit. And this is what Heifer International does. It gives people the tools to create these things themselves. Because all you really need is the ability to like pour cement and understand a few very low-grade technological concepts. And you can continue to make these until you run out of materials. You don't need a 3D printer. You know, and so suddenly, you know, your children aren't coughing and sick and burned, and you have way more free time and you have light to read and study and improve yourself. That's why I back Heifer, because they do these long-term sustainable things. And it's not maybe as flashy as saving a hurricane victim or a earthquake victim, but you know, there's a million tiny victims every day that are just kind of getting fucked by circumstance, because the only way they get to have cooked food is by lighting wood on fire in the middle of their house. Sorry, I'm a little caffeinated today.
You know, so I guess I'm somewhat of a centrist on these things. Like, I think especially in America, like, I feel very strongly that we should have a social safety net, and we should have like a guaranteed basic income for people. I think that's how you have like a just, equitable, fair society where everybody gets a fair start on a level playing field. But I'm curious, like, do you find, but I will say, like, I find it convincing when people make this argument to me of like, well, the free market is going to produce the richest rich people, but it's also going to create a rising tide that lifts all boats, and that we know, and that historically, that the free market solution and just having the success of capitalism broadly, that is the proven way to have peace, and that is the proven way to help the poorest people. You know, it's like the McDonald's doctrine of foreign policy, where until very recently, no two countries with the McDonald's had ever gone to war with each other.
Oh, that's interesting. I'd never heard that.
Yeah, like, I think the first time that ever happened was in very recent history. But the idea is, like, two countries that were sort of developed enough to sustain a McDonald's, where they had the supply chain and the public that would support the existence of McDonald's, were not capable of going to war with each other.
Wow, that's soup. That's...
Now I'm getting into, you know, at least this is sort of the conservative like viewpoint, but this, and the more reasonable, the very moderate, reasonable sort of conservative viewpoint on these things. But I don't know, I can't help but find it somewhat, you know, I'm not, my degree of confidence of my own beliefs on this, which would be much closer to sort of the Bernie Sanders, you know, social safety net, like, well, we should have free services and free college, and that we should come together as a society to take care of everyone. My confidence in that, I would not describe it as 100%. Like, I would say I find these arguments to be pretty convincing.
Yeah, I know... Well, it, what you're describing is kind of, that's what Reagan termed the trickle-down theory, right?
Well, a little bit. Reagan's, as I understand it, the trickle-down theory is that you can actually achieve that social mobility and that movement in capitalism by giving the richest people tax breaks so that they, quote-unquote, have more of an incentive to work. And the idea is that if the rich people have money, they will spend that money to create jobs for the poor people. And that's actually, I mean, regardless of your politics about what you believe about whether it's good or bad to give rich people tax breaks or fairness, all that aside, just a cold, hard look at the data proves very conclusively that that does not work. That rich people get money, they invest it, and they don't increase spending to create jobs and opportunities for people further down the social safety net.
Yeah, trickle down has been pretty thoroughly debunked. And I think, you know, what we're seeing right now in a lot of ways is sort of an elaborate pageantry that is sort of like an allegorical proof or disproof of the glory of the free market system. Because what happens with unrestrained free market capitalism is that rich people, you know, get rich, and then generally speaking, they use that money, you know, well, people with kind of a lot of money use it to buy more money. People with a lot of more money realize that's a sucker's game, and they use their money to buy power. And then they use that power to get a super lot of money. And when that happens, you end up with all of these people with money and power who then are able to orchestrate the physics of the world that they live in, by which I mean they're able to pass their own laws and their own legislation and I think we've seen pretty ample evidence that those people are going to pass legislation that makes it possible for them to get more money and more power and more control and more safety. And I don't know anyone who I really trust who would think that that system is a sustainable long term for the good of everyone system. You know, I mean, well, here, look at the other example, right? Which is, it's Sweden, you know, where they kind of have, you know, they handle a lot of these things the opposite way. Sweden is sort of the anti-US, from what I understand. You know, they have seriously high taxes, but in a lot of ways, they've privatized, I'm sorry, not privatized. What's the opposite of that?
Nationalized, yeah.
They nationalized all of the country's oil assets. And so, you know, or their natural gas or whatever. And so the government manages all their oil and natural gas, and the government sells those things. And then the government makes a profit on it. And then the government uses that money to do things like maybe pay teachers a decent wage, maybe to hire therapists for people that end up in jail because they have mental disorders. And, you know, so like everyone ends up really well educated. And if people get sick, the government makes sure that they stop being sick. And it's sort of a fucking utopia.
Well, there's if you haven't seen it, I highly, highly, highly recommend the new Michael Moore documentary called Where Should We Invade Next? And the premise of the documentary is Michael Moore is going to travel the world and figure out the country that the U.S. should invade next to, like, steal their good ideas. And it's a very uplifting, funny, light, wonderful movie. It's, in my opinion, I love Michael Moore. I love his documentaries. In my opinion, this is his best film since Bowling for Columbine. I absolutely love this movie. And there's a great chart where he, you know, as he's going through these countries and you see the unbelievable, I don't want to ruin all the surprises in the movie, but these like unbelievable school lunch programs that they have in France and the free college that they have in all of these, you know, the tiny like European countries that, you know, they're a fraction of the size of the U.S., but they educate every citizen with a free college education to these, like, beautiful factories that give people, you know, like 3 months of the year off and vacation. Like, it's just a crazy, it's just a, there's people all around the world in these small ways have things so much better than we have it. And he has this chart that I'll never forget in that movie where he's like, so in all of these countries to pay for this stuff, like the tax rate is a little bit higher. And he draws a chart and he's like, here's the U.S. tax rate for most people. And there's a line. And then here's the tax rate in all of these other countries. And it's a little bit higher on the chart. You know, I don't know, we're paying like 30-40% and they're paying, you know, I don't know, closer to 50-60% of their income. But he's like, on the other, but now let's add to this chart, what do you get for your taxes? And in these countries, they get free healthcare. They don't have any student debt. There's no concept of student debt. They get tons of paid vacation. They get tons of paid sick leave. Like, you start adding all these benefits together. And then on the US side, you have to add all the student debt that people have, the cost of college, the cost of healthcare. And suddenly, like, if once you balance all that stuff out, we're paying twice as much in taxes.
Yep.
As they are, you know, our costs are twice as high as theirs.
Yeah. Now I will say, now you've intrigued me with this movie. However, you know, I watched Bowling for Columbine and I loved it. And I thought that it was, you know, it was an amazing examination of a very complicated topic. However, since then, I'm in some ways I'm playing devil's advocate here. But this is also very true. I don't really trust Michael Moore anymore. I think that, and this is a harsh statement. I'm overstating things a little bit, but I'm doing it kind of for the sake of argument so you can push back on me. Because I really trust your opinion, and I know that you stay very well informed about these things. I have heard Michael Moore be described as the progressive's Rush Limbaugh.
Well, so there's some fact to that, and there's some differences. So what's similar is there's no doubt that it's almost that me when I go to see a Michael Moore documentary, it's vaguely pornographic, right? Like I'm going to be sort of confirmed in what I believe and titillated by how right I am and to have a laugh at the people who disagree. So that is very much like Rush Limbaugh. Like people listen, it feels good and you get the little dopamine rush from hearing the things that you believe parroted back to you and confirmed. And that is the pleasure of going to see these movies for me, no doubt. But also, like, I went to see Finding Dory, and I love that. And why did I love that? Because it was telling me a story that gave me little dopamine rushes narratively and with, you know, good emotional moments in the film. So is it really all that much different? I'm not sure. Like, I think you have
to keep... Yeah, I will step in there, and okay. I'll say Finding Dory does not present itself as a documentary.
Well, and here's where I think it really is different than Rush Limbaugh, which is this is I don't know how to say it where it's not a cliche, but these are like heavily researched, fact based, accurate things that are being told to you. And you can go on, you know, I know, for example, like on the Where Should We Invade Next, you can like go on the website and you can see, all, you know, there's millions and millions of links to all of the studies and the sources and the primary sources for all of this data. Like it is not the same with Bowling for Columbine. Like when Michael Moore gives a statistic or a fact in the movie or shows something on camera, you're seeing what you're seeing. Whereas I actually don't know too much about Rush Limbaugh, but I do know. I know there's like that great Al Franken book, Rush Limbaugh is a Big Fat Idiot. right. And then his other book, Lies and the Lying Liars Who Tell Them. It's like those are pretty condemning looks at some of that right wing media where they know that they're lying. And they're lying anyway. And in fact, I think like Bill, in the case of like the Al Franken book, Lies and the Lying Liars Who Tell Them, I think Bill O'Reilly sued Al Franken in court for calling him a liar for libel. And Al Franken went to court and proved that that Bill O'Reilly was a liar, and he won.
It's right. It's not defamation if it is a truth.
Right. And he proved that he lied and repeatedly about many things. And the court found in Franken's favor.
And that actually, that's my only real, you know, because, you know, honestly, it's like, I like the fight, you know, that Moore is fighting. It's in many ways the same fight that I am fighting. But one of my major hesitations is that I fear that in his desire to persuade, he engages in some borderline or unethical behavior in the presentation of his facts, or maybe in the implication of what is a fact. And I know that's been an issue in some of his documentaries where he's, you know, like Fahrenheit 9/11, you know? When he did that one, there was a lot of there were some things in there that, in my opinion, like they were dirty pool in terms of persuasion,
right?
If not like downright misleading.
Well, it's interesting because these documentaries, I mean, I think this just comes down to I think this is going to come down to sort of a personal. I think people just need to decide for themselves, like. You know, where what their views on the role of a documentary is. I mean, there's no doubt that a Michael Moore film is emotionally manipulative in that it is using music and the tricks of filmmaking and characterization and using sympathetic interviewees and things like that to emotionally bring you on his side using all the tricks of filmmaking. And it's not just, you know, you're right. It's not like Finding Dory and that he's just trying to tell a story. Like he is trying to persuade you to his political point. And I think that you can I think there's a debate to be had about, well, is a documentary allowed to be emotionally manipulative? But I would also say there is a little bit of a myth of neutrality in reporting and documentary making, where even a cinema verite documentary, which is just where you turn the camera on and show what the camera sees, that is, there is no absence of editorial opinion in that either, because you still have to decide what to point the camera at and when to cut and what to show and what to exclude. So and, if anything, maybe there's something more honest about Michael Moore, where he comes, he himself comes on screen and says, I'm going to persuade you to believe the thing that I believe, and then hits you in the gut with the music and the editing and the, all of these filmmaking tricks. But I think that's where people start to feel like, well, if he's tricking me with this, if he's using the tools of filmmaking to manipulate me, are the facts massaged? And that, from my, I mean, I can only speak for what I know about this stuff, and I'm well aware, I'm sure we're going to get a million emails from people, I'm well aware of all the right-wing websites that, like, debunk, you know, call into question and debunk all his facts, but from everything I've seen and read, his stuff is very fairly presented in research. Like, I do not think he is lying at face value about the things he's reporting and the facts that he is saying and the things the camera is showing. I think that's where you can get into a little bit of, like, this idea of, like, both-sidism that the media will do, where it's like, well, if CNN is going to have someone, a scientist, to talk about global warming, they have to have a global warming denier on to get the other side. And and that's where I'm, like, suspicious of, like, well, I think it's actually fair to say that right-wing media actually does habitually distort facts and manipulate the truth and believe that the truth is more of a point of view or a relative thing. And, you know, at least in the case of the left-wing stuff that I like maybe it's just because I'm picking it based on this, but I feel like it's at least has its feet on the ground in terms of, like, okay, we all live in, like, an objective reality and there is such a thing as a fact.
Yeah, and I will just to clarify, you know, him using storytelling tricks or cinematography tricks or musical, and I shouldn't say tricks, these are tools. These are persuasive tools. And you're right. There is an honesty in him, you know, going out and saying, here's what I'm going to persuade you of. And here we go. You know, in some ways, it would be kind of dishonest to say, let's take an objective look at, like, no. That's, don't bullshit me.
Right.
And for me, the only thing that I flinch away from is, you know, is the potential of either misleading or untrue facts, and actually hearing you to speak to the veracity of his facts reassures me to that point, because I'd heard some of this pushback where people had, you know, kind of looked into a lot of his claims and saw that he was doing, again, with things with his facts or presenting things as facts that were not. But I know you like your research, so the fact that you're kind of vouching for his research makes me, you know, makes me want to trust him more.
I would say from the stuff I've read, I mean, again, it's you know, like I said with the Steven Pinker book, like, it's not uncontroversial. Like, there is lots of debate over, did he show this thing, did he portray this issue fairly or not? But I think just in terms of, like, if that guy puts a number on the screen, that number is from a primary source that you would approve of. Like, you know, he's not, it's not on its surface bullshit. Yeah, and one shit, you know,
one final follow-up. I do agree, and I think there is a really, honestly, it's not just disturbing, it's kind of a terrifying trend in some of, I don't want to use the term right-wing media. Is there a way for me to say that?
No, it's fine. I think it's fair. I think we're acknowledging that Michael Moore is left-wing media.
Yeah, that's true. We're labeling him. So, but I do think you're absolutely right. There is, I mean, just look at Trump. You know, Trump just says things that are just like, you don't even need to compare them to other things. They're just, like, inherently untrue in the statement itself. Like, for anyone that has a perception of reality, and I guess that's why I was so flinchy about Moore. Because I'm like, those are the tools of the enemy, and we have to be better than that, you know? So, like, even if he had dabbled in it a little bit, I'm like, ugh, I can't trust you. You can't really be on my side, you know? once you've used the power of the ring, you're dirty, you know?
Well, I'll say, so, and this is another, like tying our whole conversation together. So we were talking before about meditation. You were like, you know, I think once you start to look into, like, quantum physics and spirituality and philosophy, and there's this point of convergence, and, you know, I didn't want to get into it, but I really disagree with that.
Oh,
where I felt a little defensive about that was, like, I actually think there's a characteristic to philosophy that makes it a little bit different, where philosophy actually, and I hear this is a very popular sentiment right now. People are like, oh, well, do we need philosophy anymore? Like, can't we just replace philosophy with research and with neuroscience? Like, can't we just get answers to these things and figure out, well, what is it that makes people the happiest? Or, you know, we'll just discover the truth about the universe through physics and math. I mean, most of my friends sort of hold those beliefs. They're like, well, these are just solvable problems. And there's an idea in philosophy to me of there is always that science and math and discovery and all these things, you know, political justice, political progress, these are not ends in and of themselves. And the philosophy is about, it's the meta science of looking at, like, well, what are our ends and how do we come to them? And I have a couple of strong belief, philosophical beliefs about this. So I, for example, like one of the ideas in philosophy that I'm very interested in comes from Immanuel Kant, and it's this idea of a deontological system of virtues. So when we decide what's right or wrong, we actually don't want that to be based on facts. That we want to actually come up with ideas of what is true and good and right and just, absent any facts. So the example I would give to explain that is, like, look at gay marriage. So to me, like, one of the biggest arguments for gay marriage is, well, homosexuality is not a choice. People are born that way. So it's wrong to deny them rights because of the way that they're born. And that has proven to be a very politically effective and persuasive argument that has led to gay marriage. And however, I actually personally hate that argument, because let's say that tomorrow there's a big scientific breakthrough and we discover that you actually can choose not to be gay, that there's like a pill or a surgery or something and you could change your sexual orientation. Would it then be wrong to deny people the right to marry each other?
Exactly. I couldn't agree more. Again, this was part of the conversation I ended up having with Sarah just last night. We were talking about I think of it as the hypothetical versus the real. Or, you know, if you want to go full on philosophical, it's nomos versus phusis. You know, it's the observed versus, like, the... Well, yeah, okay. Let's not go.
This is my please keep going. This is my shit. I'm like, I am rock hard for ancient Greek philosophy terms.
this is why we're friends. Well, that's where the word physics comes from, because I haven't bumped into this, I think, since I took a epistemology, and that class was early in the morning. You have nomos and phusis, and phusis is where we get the word for physics, and that was the ancient Greek, I think it was Plato or Aristotle, and he said that's nature, effectively. That is the world. And that's why we have the word physics. Physics is the study of the nature of reality. It's the world. Now, nomos is constructed reality. And that means, like, logical constructs or laws or human behavior and stuff like that. I agree with you in that we should determine what is right based off this desire for a pure concept rather than something that is necessarily anchored to the world. And God, this goes, like, way into the, like, the dark heart of epistemology, which is, like, is there true knowledge, which is something that people are still arguing over, like, 4,000 years later.
Well, and to bring it, and the reason I think this whole conversation is relevant is this is where it's when I'm trying to evaluate, like, well, how seriously do I take, like, a Michael Moore documentary or something like that? Like, you know, I want all of the facts to line up. That's a requirement for me. And I don't want to be lied to, because there's an issue of credibility. But there's a deeper issue too, which is, like, well, what is this about? Like, is it about, and you know, to me, it's like the thing that appeals to me about, well, especially about this new documentary, the Where Should We Invade Next, it's like, it's just about justice, and it's about what's right and what's decent and what's fair for people. And then, you know, if there is some sort of tools of emotional manipulation being brought to bear in the name of that, like I'm willing to tolerate that. And I think that the argument he's, I think that the research and the argument he's doing and the story he's telling is really good and compelling, and the facts fall into place.
The one that came up last night when I was talking with Sarah, we were talking about a bunch of things, and I'm like, okay, let's move away from what we're actually talking about. And I want to address this issue, you know, in a different situation that we will not be emotionally tied to. And the example that I used actually worked out pretty well. And I said, you know, about an emergency tracheotomy, and I'm assuming you do too, right?
No, actually.
You know, an emergency tracheotomy is when somebody has maybe suffered damage to their larynx or they have an obstructed airway. And so they're suffocating, like genuinely suffocating. And so what you do is you actually have to cut, you know, your trachea is your voice box.
Mm-hmm.
What you do is you cut a hole through their throat, through their trachea, and you take like a tube, like you take a straw or a Bic pen that you pull the guts out of, and you insert it into the trachea. And it's a big life-saving thing because air can get through the tube and through their trachea, and it'll bypass the obstruction if like something's stuck in their throat. You know, and because like you can't perform CPR on somebody if they have an obstructed airway, and that means they will be like for real dead, brain going away in 4 minutes. Or you can perform an emergency tracheotomy. Now, this is tricky because I just described it to you, but for Sarah, she was like, "Oh yeah, I know what it is." And I go, "And you agree that like if somebody is dying, you should do it, right?" And she goes, "Well, yeah, of course." And I go, "Now, can you imagine what it would be like to do it? Can you imagine actually like taking a pocket knife and pressing it into somebody's throat while they're alive and struggling for breath? And the fact that blood will come out and you will have to puncture the cartilage of their trachea and then stick something in there. Like blood will come out. It will get on your hands." And then I was talking about that and she goes, oh, she made kind of the exact same noise that you just made. And I go, "So would you do it?" And she's like, "Well, yeah." And I'm like, the difference is, one, you were talking about the concept, this hypothetical, which is like, here's a thing that if you do it, you know, you have a very good chance of saving this person's life. Should you do it? And in the hypothetical, you go, "Yes." Now, if you start digging into the reality of the situation, it's not that these other facts that you bring in help inform the situation. They don't. The true situation is, if you do this thing, you have the chance of saving a life. Is saving a life good? Yes. Therefore, do the thing. But when you bring in this other information, it doesn't clarify the issue. These facts, and they are facts, you will get blood on your hands. This person will struggle. It will cause them pain. But these facts are not clarifying because ultimately they're not relevant to the underlying heart of the situation. They are what you're actually doing when you engage in that behavior is you're looking for a way to make either yourself or someone else uncomfortable. And that moves them away from the truth of the situation, that it is, yeah, it's a good thing to save a life. We can pretty much all agree on that.
Do you know about Roger Fisher's proposed nuclear protocol that the president should have to use to launch a nuclear weapon?
Oh, no, but I can guess what it is.
You're going to love this. So this is a law professor, and I think he was a veteran named Roger Fisher. And
Hold on, let me, can I guess?
Oh, sure, yeah.
And I'm going to feel really awful if I'm wrong, because this might show something really dark in my personality. This is actually, I have trouble imagining saying this out loud, let alone being recorded. but in the context of this conversation, I can say before the president can make a nuclear strike, he would have to, like, willingly kill a baby.
Well, let me read you the proposal. So this is this is from Roger Fisher. I think he was a World War II veteran and sort of saw warfare and then became a legal scholar, and he came up with this idea. So he says, the procedure in real life is there's a young man, probably a Navy officer, who accompanies the president. The young man has a black attaché case which contains the codes that are needed to fire nuclear weapons. I could see the president at a staff meeting considering nuclear war as an abstract question. He might conclude on SIOP Plan 1, the decision is affirmative, communicate the Alpha Line XYZ. Such jargon holds what is involved at a distance. My suggestion is quite simple. Put that needed code number in a little capsule and then implant the capsule right next to the heart of a volunteer. The volunteer would then carry with him a big, heavy butcher knife as he accompanies the president. If the president ever wants to fire nuclear weapons, the only way he could do so would be for him to first, with his own hands, kill one human being. The president says, George, I'm sorry, but tens of millions must die. He must look at someone in the eyes and realize what death is, what an innocent death is. Blood on the carpet of the White House, its reality brought home. When I suggested this to friends at the Pentagon, they said, my God, that's terrible. Having to kill someone would distort the president's judgment, and he might never push the button.
That's, you know, I feel bad that I went immediately to kill a baby.